You know, every single day, you probably perform a dozen acts of absolute blind faith without even really realizing it. You walk into a high-rise office building, you step into a metal box suspended by braiding steel cables, and you shoot up 30 floors. You sit for 8 hours under heavy, suspended light fixtures, right?
Right, exactly. It's wild when you think about it.
And you plug your laptop into a wall socket, buzzing with like lethal amounts of electricity. You do all of this day in and day out without once looking up and wondering if the ceiling is just going to collapse on you.
It is a profound, almost subconscious level of trust. I mean, we just assume the environment we step into has been meticulously designed to keep us alive, but that assumption isn't magic.
Right.
It isn't just good luck or even basic human decency. That safety is entirely manufactured.
Manufactured and strictly mandated. So today's deep dive is into the invisible scaffolding that keeps that ceiling from falling on your head. We pulled out a stack of sources today, specifically looking at a foundational piece of South African legislation. It's the Occupational Health and Safety Act, number 85 of 1993, as published in the Government Gazette, volume 337, number 11918.
Which, you know, a government legal document from over 30 years ago might sound like a guaranteed cure for insomnia.
Oh, for sure. It sounds super dry.
But diving into this text actually reveals something fascinating. It doesn't just list a bunch of boring, static rules about, like, how wide a staircase needs to be. It creates this living, breathing ecosystem of accountability. It is essentially a psychological masterclass in making humans care about other humans' survival.
Exactly. So our mission today is to translate this dense 1993 government legalese into the fascinating real-world mechanics of your own daily workplace survival. We are stripping away the jargon to reveal the intricate web of rules that literally governs whether you and millions of other people come home safe from work every day.
Yeah. Consider this a survival guide you didn't even know you needed.
Let's get right into it.
Well, to understand how this survival guide works in practice, we have to start with the core philosophy the Act uses to define the word safe. Because legally speaking, safe does not mean building an indestructible padded bubble around every single worker.
Right.
The entire law hinges on a very specific, highly pragmatic legal phrase. And that phrase is reasonably practicable.
Okay, let's unpack this because reasonably practicable sounds like lawyer speak for, we'll do our best unless it's too hard.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like a massive loophole, but the Act actually defines it using a very strict four-part test.
It does. The law requires an employer to look at four distinct variables when facing a hazard. First, the severity and scope of the hazard. Basically, how likely is this to kill or maim someone, and how many people are exposed to it?
Okay, that makes sense.
Second is the state of knowledge about that hazard. What does the industry currently know about how to stop it? You know, are there proven solutions out there? Third, the suitability of the means to mitigate it. Does the proposed solution actually work in this specific environment? And fourth, and this is the big one, the cost of removing the hazard relative to the benefits deriving from that removal.
Okay, that fourth point is the one I really want to push back on, the cost.
Yeah, the cost aspect is always a bit jarring.
It just feels incredibly cold to see a price tag put on human safety written down in black and white in a government document. It reminds me of like deciding whether to wear a helmet on a bicycle versus a government mandate that all bicycles must be surrounded by a titanium roll cage.
Right.
A titanium roll cage would definitively save more lives. But at some point, the law steps in and says, look, the roll cage is simply too expensive relative to the benefit. The math doesn't work. Just wear the helmet.
What's fascinating here is that the law is openly acknowledging the reality of a capitalist society. I mean, it is forcing a mathematical calculation on human safety because it recognizes that a zero-risk society is, well, it's an impossible society.
Wow. Yeah, I guess so.
If we mandated titanium roll cages for every conceivable risk, businesses simply couldn't function. We wouldn't build bridges, we wouldn't mine minerals, the economy would halt entirely. So the genius of the Act isn't in demanding perfection, it's in demanding a rigorous, documented risk calculation.
But the law doesn't just, it doesn't just let employers do that math and take the cheapest option.
No, not at all. The Act is actually incredibly specific about the hierarchy of how you mitigate those risks once you identify them. It dictates that employers must take steps to eliminate or mitigate hazards at the source before resorting to personal protective equipment.
You mean PPE? Things like hard hats, safety goggles, steel-toed boots.
Exactly. Handing a worker a hard hat is legally the absolute last resort.
Wait, really? The last resort?
Yeah, it is a failure of earlier mitigation. The employer's absolute first duty is to fix the machine so it stops spitting out flying metal debris in the first place.
Mm.
You know, put a guard on the saw. Install a ventilation system to suck the toxic fumes out of the air.
Oh.
Only if it is mathematically and physically not reasonably practicable to alter the environment do you then resort to putting a helmet or a respirator on the human being.
You engineer the environment before you armor the human. That is a brilliant distinction. But, you know, writing a beautiful mathematical philosophy about risk and mitigation on a piece of paper in 1993 doesn't actually stop a factory manager today from cutting corners to save a buck.
No, it certainly doesn't.
So who is actually required to do this math?
Well, instinctively, we picture this CEO or the site manager.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, the boss.
But the legislation pulls a massive structural maneuver here. It spreads the responsibility across a massive web. It's an interlocking chain of liability that extends from the external manufacturer of the equipment down through the management chain, right onto the factory floor, and out to third-party contractors.
Let's look at the manufacturer's liability, because this is wild. Mm. The Act dictates that anyone who designs, imports, sells, or supplies any article for use at work must ensure it is safe when properly used.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is about ensuring no entity in the supply chain can play dumb or just pass the buck. Let's examine that phrase, properly used.
Okay.
It serves as a vital legal shield for the manufacturer, but it also establishes their absolute baseline duty. Imagine you manufacture a standard steel hammer.
Okay, a hammer.
If a construction worker decides to use that hammer to strike a stick of dynamite and it explodes, you, the manufacturer, are completely shielded. That is obviously not the hammer being properly used.
I mean, yeah, the hammer company can't be sued for explosive misuse. That completely makes sense.
However, if a worker is simply driving a standard nail into a standard piece of wood and the metal head of that hammer shatters into shrapnel and blinds them, the manufacturer is absolutely in the crosshairs of the Act.
Because they failed to ensure it was safe under normal operating conditions.
Exactly. The web of responsibility and liability begins thousands of miles away, long before the tool ever arrives at your specific workplace.
And then that web of responsibility drops directly onto the employees themselves. This blew my mind while reading through our sources.
It surprises a lot of people.
The Act lays out severe legal duties for the everyday employee. Like, if I am just an average entry-level worker and I walk into the break room and see a frayed electrical wire near the coffee machine, my instinct might be, well, I'm not an electrician. It's not my job to fix it.
Which is a very normal human reaction.
Right. But if I don't report it to someone, am I actually violating the Act?
You are actively breaking the law.
Wow.
Yeah. Employees are legally mandated to take reasonable care of their own safety, to obey lawful safety orders, and crucially, to report any unsafe situations to the employer or to a health and safety representative as soon as practicable. You cannot look the other way.
So the bystander effect is essentially illegal in the workplace.
It is. Furthermore, the law strictly forbids anyone from intentionally or recklessly interfering with or misusing safety equipment.
Okay, so if I prop open a heavy fire door with a fire extinguisher just because it's a hot day in the office and I want a breeze.
You are committing an offense, without question. You are actively degrading the engineered safety of the environment. The burden is inherently shared here.
That is fascinating.
And importantly, the law doesn't let executives loophole their way out of this shared burden by relying on the gig economy or temporary labor. There's a whole clause dealing with the mandatory.
Right, the mandatory, which is the legal term for contractors or subcontractors.
Exactly.
I love this part. It's like trying to hire someone else to take your driving test for you. You can pay them to sit in the car, but you can't outsource the liability if they crash it. The law treats that subcontractor as a direct extension of the employer unless there is a highly specific, legally binding written agreement stating otherwise.
Yeah, a company can't just outsource their most dangerous, toxic work to a fly-by-night contractor and suddenly wash their hands of the safety liability. The ecosystem is designed to be airtight. Every single person in the chain is holding a piece of the liability puzzle.
But an airtight ecosystem of rules is completely useless without a surveillance system to monitor it in the dirt, noise, and chaos of the real world.
Which brings us to the actual boots on the ground.
Here's where it gets really interesting. How does the law ensure these rules aren't just theoretical? Well, it mandates the creation of two distinct types of enforcers, the internal watchdogs and the external apex predators.
The internal watchdogs are the health and safety representatives. The Act mandates that if an employer has more than 20 employees, they are legally required to designate these reps from among their full-time staff.
And the math behind the required ratios tells a very clear story about risk assessment.
It really does.
For standard shops and offices, the rule is you need at least one representative for every 100 employees. But for all other workplaces, which translates to factories, construction sites, chemical plants, places with heavy moving machinery, you need one representative for every 50 employees.
It goes directly back to that reasonably practicable risk calculation. A massive warehouse with roaring forklifts, blind corners, and heavy pallets is inherently more lethal than a carpeted accounting firm. So the density of surveillance, the sheer number of eyes on the floor actively looking for hazards, needs to be twice as high.
Wow, yeah.
And if you have a large enough facility to require two or more of these reps, the law demands the formation of a health and safety committee that must formally meet and review hazard reports at least every 3 months.
But let's look at the actual social dynamics of that for a second. You have a 25-year-old forklift driver who is designated as the safety rep. They notice the warehouse shelving is buckling. They take it to the 55-year-old site manager who is totally stressed about hitting quarterly profit targets.
Right.
The manager says, "We don't have the budget, just ignore it." What happens then? Because an internal watchdog doesn't have much bite against their own boss.
And that's exactly when you call in the external apex predators, the inspectors.
Inspectors.
Designated by the minister. The inspectors are the ultimate authority in this ecosystem. They are the external muscle. And the powers granted to them by this legislation are genuinely staggering.
I read through their list of powers and pictured a workplace deity descending from the clouds. I mean, an inspector can enter your premises at any reasonable time, entirely unannounced. They don't need to politely make an appointment or wait in the lobby.
No, they don't.
They can seize documents, demand immediate explanations, and my absolute favorite part, the law allows them to literally block, bar, barricade, or fence off a part of the workplace or a piece of machinery.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the inspector is the great equalizer of power. The internal health and safety reps and the committees democratize safety. They give the vulnerable workers on the floor a legal voice to spot hazards. But the inspector is the legal hammer that ensures the employer actually listens to that voice. If management refuses to fix a lethal piece of equipment, the inspector doesn't just issue a strongly worded memo. They can walk onto your multi-million dollar production line, build a literal physical fence around your core machine, and halt your production entirely until you prove the hazard is mitigated.
You cannot ignore yellow tape and a barricade in the middle of your factory. It is a highly visceral, physical manifestation of the law stepping into the real world.
Oh, definitely.
But of course, despite the careful calculations, the watchdogs and the barricade building inspectors, accidents still happen.
They do.
Wrenches get dropped, wires short out. And when the absolute worst occurs, this legislation suddenly stops reading like a dry labor guideline and transforms into a tense criminal law document.
When the system fails, it becomes a matter of life, death, and potential liberty. The Act dictates a very strict protocol for the immediate aftermath of a severe accident. If someone dies, becomes unconscious, loses a limb, or even if they are just injured badly enough that they'll be unable to work for 14 days, it triggers a mandatory reporting event to an inspector.
So what does this all mean for the coworkers standing around when it happens? Because there is an incredible psychological tension in the text of the law here. It's the crime scene rule.
Yes.
If a person dies or looks like they might die, the law states that absolutely no person shall disturb the site or remove any article without the express consent of an inspector. The only permitted exception is if you have to move things to prevent a further incident or to rescue the injured person.
Picture the terrifying reality of that moment. A catastrophic accident has just occurred on a noisy floor. Human instinct is panic, chaos, trying to clean up, trying to figure out what just broke, maybe even trying to hide a mistake out of fear.
Oh, for sure. Panic just takes over.
But the law demands that you freeze. You are now standing in a potential crime scene. You cannot hide the broken gear. You cannot sweep away the metal shavings. You must preserve the absolute truth of the failure so the inspector can forensically determine where the ecosystem broke down.
And speaking of truth and fear, what about the people who speak up before the accident happens? Like, if my boss is actively cutting corners, ignoring barricades, and covering up hazards, blowing the whistle feels like a fast track to getting fired and losing my livelihood.
This raises an important question about the courage required to maintain this entire legal structure. The Act completely anticipates this fear. There's an entire section dedicated exclusively to forbidding victimization.
Oh, really?
Yeah. An employer cannot dismiss an employee, reduce their pay, or alter their terms of employment to their disadvantage, simply because that employee gave information to an inspector or complied with a safety mandate. It acts as a legal shield.
Wow, okay.
The architects of this law recognize that the whole system collapses overnight if workers are too terrified of starvation to report a hazard.
But what if the employer just ignores all of this? If their negligence does cause a severed limb or a death, the penalties are severe.
Very severe. For a standard offense, say refusing to answer an inspector's questions or tampering with safety gear, it's fined of up to R$50,000 or up to 1 year in prison.
Okay, so that's the baseline.
But there is a critical, fascinating escalation built into the penalties. Mm-hmm. If an employer does or omits to do an act that causes injury, and that act would have been considered culpable homicide if the person had actually died.
Wait, what happens?
The penalty essentially doubles. It jumps to a fine of up to R$100,000 or 2 years in prison, irrespective of whether the victim actually died or just got injured.
Wait, before we move on, culpable homicide is a heavy legal term. For those of us who aren't lawyers, how is that different from just standard tragic negligence?
Well, it's the difference between an unforeseeable accident and reckless disregard. Culpable homicide involves the unlawful, negligent killing of a human being. It means a reasonable person in that employer's position would have foreseen that their actions, or their failure to act, could result in death, and they failed to take steps to guard against it.
Ah, I see.
By tying the corporate penalty to this criminal concept, the law is targeting the board of directors' risk calculus.
That is heavy. It's basically telling executives sitting in a boardroom or on a golf course, if your sloppiness and budget cuts could have killed someone, we are punishing you for the lethal potential of your actions. We are punishing your failure to foresee the obvious, not just relying on the lucky outcome that the worker happened to survive.
It brilliantly reinforces the ultimate stakes. This isn't just about regulatory compliance checklists or filing paperwork on time. It is about the fundamental, unalienable right of a human being to not be killed by the environment that pays their salary.
Which brings us full circle. We've gone on quite a journey today through the depths of this 1993 government gazette.
We really have.
We started with the philosophical cost-benefit math of what is reasonably practicable and whether we can afford titanium roll cages. We traced the interlocking web of shared responsibility from a tool manufacturer thousands of miles away down to the entry-level employee reporting a frayed break room wire.
Yeah, we met the internal watchdogs and the barricade-building external inspectors.
Right. And finally, we looked at the stark, adrenaline-fueled realities of a workplace crime scene and the very real threat of prison for reckless executives.
When you step back and look at it as a whole, it is a masterful piece of systemic design. And it's vital to remember why you, as a listener, should care about the mechanics of this document. Every product you buy, every office you sit in, every service you utilize in your daily life is built on top of this exact kind of legislative scaffolding.
It really is.
It is the hidden social contract of modern civilization. It is the sole reason we do not live in a world where factories are just accepted as meat grinders for human capital.
But before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a thought experiment to mull over.
Okay, let's hear it.
We've been dissecting a piece of legislation written in 1993. It was drafted in a time heavily predicated on physical premises. It envisions sprawling factories, retail shops, towering high-rises, and heavy machinery.
Right.
But the world has profoundly changed. Today, we live in an era of remote work, hybrid schedules, and digital nomadism. For millions of people listening right now, your workplace might be your living room couch, a spare bedroom, or a tiny table at a local coffee shop.
Yeah, that's true for so many of us.
So here is the question. If you are working from home and you trip over your own laptop cord while on company time, severely injuring yourself, where does the employer's liability end and your private life begin? Does the formidable barricade-building power of the inspector extend into your home office?
Wow. It's a blurry, complicated line that the legislation of tomorrow is going to have to figure out. Because the physical location changes, but the core philosophical question remains, what is reasonably practicable when the hazardous workplace is your own living room?
So tomorrow, when you walk into your corporate building or sit down at your warehouse station or even just log on from your kitchen table, take a second to appreciate the invisible scaffolding holding it all together. Because that assumption that the ceiling won't collapse, that's not luck. That's the law.